Anyway, this perhaps gives you just some idea of our activities and the sort of impact that we're making. And some of you might be a bit surprised that people should be turning to the FWBO, even though it might be disguised as Trilokya Bodhavaha Sangha Sahaya Kagana, which I hope you have learned by this time. because after all, you know, the FWBO was started in England, and this is India, and India is the land of the Buddha and all that. And aren't we rather taking your calls to Newcastle? But it doesn't seem so. In fact, thinking things over, it does seem very much as though there's a certain similarity between the positions of Buddhists in England, certainly, Buddhists in the United Kingdom, and Buddhists in India, certainly Buddhists in Maharashtra, the Santoshwa Buddhists. Yeah? And the main point of the similarity is this, that they're all new Buddhists. That is to say, they're all people who've chosen to be Buddhists. They haven't inherited their Buddhism. They don't just blindly follow tradition. And this, I found, is a point that Lokha Mitra stresses very, very much. He says in nearly all his lectures, certainly when speaking in a new place, that we are all new Buddhists, just like you. You are new Buddhists, just like us. Buddhism isn't something that we've inherited from our forebears. It's something we've decided to follow. But of course it isn't easy. If you're born as a Buddhist, if you can be born as a Buddhist, in fact, you tend perhaps to follow very mechanically. You think you know it all already. Buddhism isn't very fresh or very alive for you. But if you choose it, after a lot of thought to yourself, after a lot of suffering, then you've got a very, very different attitude towards it. So because Indian Buddhists are new Buddhists, and because Buddhists from the United Kingdom, or Buddhists from New Zealand for that matter, because Buddhists from New Zealand are new Buddhists, well, they've got a much better basis for understanding than either of them have, you know, with Buddhists perhaps who are Buddhists by tradition, by birth, and by inheritance. And not only that, even apart from that, they just like our approach. They like the FWBO approach. It makes sense to them. They find it meaningful. They like our methods. They like our system. They like our meditations. They like our retreats. They like our study groups. They like our Mitra system. This is the whole FWBO system was designed specifically for the Indian situation. It's really extraordinary. As everybody knows, well, no, it was worked out in England mainly for the benefit of Westerners. Not only for the benefit of people from different parts of the United Kingdom, but people from America, people from Germany, you know, people from Holland. We, at that time, didn't think very much in specific terms of the needs of our friends in India. But transporting the whole system, so to speak, lock, stock and barrel, as set forth by Subhuti in his new book, to India, it seems to meet their needs just like a glove. As though it was that you're tailored for them, which is really extraordinary. They feel quite at home with them. With our system, it makes sense to them. In other words, the fact that it comes from England and isn't of Indian origin is an additional recommendation, because they tend to think that anything of Indian origin is tainted with Brahmanism, tainted with the Hindu caste system. And of course there is, you know, some truth in that. There's also the point that Buddhists from Buddhist countries, even Buddhist monks, lamas, have done practically nothing for the ex-Santoshwa Buddhists. There's 4 million of them, but there's hardly anybody gone to work among them from Ceylon, from Thailand, from Burma, from Tibet. No one seems to bother. It's only apparently the Buddhists from the West who bother, and they appreciate this very much. And they're not at all, as it were, put off by the fact that we're English or New Zealand or whatever. They rather like that, because they feel we're likely to be free from any Hindu influence, and they're very afraid of that Hindu influence, because they've suffered from it very much. There are a couple of things I mentioned in lectures which seemed especially to appeal to them. Things which I hadn't mentioned much before, certainly hadn't mentioned 20 years ago. They very much like this idea of a Buddhist movement being self-supporting financially, and especially through its co-ops. They really like this idea very much. This whole idea of religious mendicancy, sort of depending for the support of the religious activities on charitable donors, they don't like that system very much. It smacks too much of beggary, And of course they were forced formerly to live as beggars, so they don't like that. The idea that you don't ask the public for anything, that you work yourself, that you have your co-ops, that the profits from the co-ops go towards running the Buddhist activities. They really like this idea. They really appreciate it in a way that I really can't describe. And then another point I mentioned this time, I made a point of mentioning it, was teamwork. That in the FWW we don't have leaders. In India they have a great weakness for leaders. They're always clamouring for a leader, someone to lead them. This is a great weakness in the Indian character. It's a weakness in their politics. I mean, look, for instance, at the way Mrs. Gandhi's surviving son is being groomed, apparently, to succeed his mother. Why? Because he's his mother's son. He's his grandfather's grandson. For no other reason, apparently. He's a nice young man, but he was interested formerly just in flying aeroplanes. He wasn't interested in politics. But anyway, his elder brother, who was interested in politics, died, and so India's got to be provided with a leader, of course, has to come from above, dropped down from heaven, as it were. So this young man is being groomed, rather late in life, actually. So India's always looking for leaders. They're always sort of looking for help from outside, always looking for some big influential person, whether political or religious, to solve all their problems for them, and they can just blindly follow. So I really hammered this sort of ideology in my lectures. And I must say, incidentally, that the way I speak in my lectures in India is rather different, you know, from the way I speak here. So the language may be the same, but I'm very, very much more blunt. One of our English friends were a bit shocked at the bluntness and crudity of, you know, some of my expressions. But you're speaking most of the time to illiterate people, people who are not highly educated, people with very sort of, what shall I say, rough and ready minds. They see things a bit in black and white terms. They're not concerned with refinements of thought and language. They want it sort of strong and straight from the shoulder. They like that. So, you know, this is the way I was talking to them most of the time. And this was the way in which I was sort of hammering this idea of leadership and saying, in the FWB, we don't have leaders. We have teams of people working together. This is the spirit of Sangha, that people work together. And do things together as teams. And this idea also they really liked, because they have already been fed up, you know, with their so-called leaders, people who tried to lead them and who failed dismally. And they liked the idea of just teams of people doing things together.